Sunday, December 22nd at 11 p.m., Sugar in My Bowl will take a look back at Nelson Mandela and the South African freedom struggle. Join us as we hear insights from radio personality Bob Law, Omowale Clay of the December 12th Movement, Ingrid Munson, Quincy Jones Professor of African American Music at Harvard, poet Rashida Ismaili Abubakar, and excerpts from a presentation by Nana Dr. Leonard Jeffries. That's Sunday, December 22nd at 11 p.m., right here on WBAI New York, 99.5 FM, and WBAI.org on the web. WBAI New York, 99.5 FM. Sugar in My Bowl is the name of this program, and tonight we will focus on Nelson Mandela and the South African freedom struggle. We didn't get a chance to do it last week. We didn't get a chance to send off Madiba last week because we were in fundraising mode. So I was originally planning to play holiday music, but we had to do this. This was so necessary. And I also would like to thank and apologize to the radio personality Bob Law. I thank him for putting together the event that took place where Nana Dr. Leonard Jeffries was recorded. Unfortunately, I'm not able to use the sound that I got from him, but he served a good function by making that event available and also helping me be able to record. What's this program? I want some sugar in my bowl. And let's set the tone.
Truly, the people in South Africa celebrated not just Nelson Mandela, the individual. They celebrated the movement of African liberation. And he became the focus, clearly, because he was a specially endowed person. He had what I refer to often as the sacred mission to do something special in life. But we have to realize that 27 years of that life was inside. There was not much he could do but be a symbol. And so the struggle had to be carried on by others who were outside. And that included Winnie Mandela. And I was so glad that they gave her her props and her kudos, and she was dressed in her mourning black. That's not Winnie. Winnie likes to express her African self, but she was dignified and with the other widow, Rashia Michelle, and they showed the strength of the black women. But Winnie was a special fighter in the struggle. When she went, people got stirred up, and she was the first to come out with Nelson, and her hand was in the air. His hand came up after her hand was waving in the air. And so we need to see the great struggle of a people through this individual.
There's a train that comes from Namibia and Malawi There's a train that comes from Zambia and Zimbabwe. There's a train that comes from Angola and Mozambique. From Lesotho, from Botswana, from Swaziland. From all the hinterlands of southern and central Africa. This train carries young and old African men who are conscripted to come and work on contract in the gold and mineral mines of Johannesburg and its surrounding metropoli. 16 hours or more a day for almost no pay. Deep, deep, deep down in the belly of the earth, when they are digging and drilling for that shiny, mighty, evasive stone, or when they dish that mishmash mush food into their iron plates with the iron shovel, or when they sit in their stinky, funky, filthy, flea-ridden barracks and hostels, they think about the loved ones they may never see again because they might already have been forcibly removed from where they last left them, or wantonly murdered in the dead of night by roving and marauding gangs of no particular origin. We are told to think about their lands and their herds that were taken away from them with the gun and the bomb and the tear gas and the Gatling and the cannon. And when they hear that choo-choo train, a chugging and a pumping and a smoking and a pushing and a pumping, crying and a steaming and a chicken and a they always curse and they curse the coal train. The coal train that brought them to Johannesburg.
And the men were not there because the South African economic system said that the black man is going to be super exploited, just like they say it here in our culture. Now, it used to be you pick the cotton and chop the cane, and then you had that peonage after Civil War and Reconstruction, and now you got the black men heading from their house into the street, into the school, into the jailhouse. South Africa's black men were in the mines. The labor system of South Africa needs to be understood. While we celebrate Nelson Mandela, we have to see why he was able to have this feeling for his people in such a way, and what the people did. The women are the key to the liberation in South Africa. Men were in hostels. What are hostels? Not things where the Europeans come with a pack on their back in America and they're going around and they want some cheap housing. Hostels were virtual slave labor camps where the men were recruited to go into the mines, not for a weekend, not for a month, but they had a contract for several years. Those men in the mines, those men working those work camps, had to go every day through the dehumanizing process of having people look up their behinds to make sure there wasn't gold or diamonds in their innards. Men were separated from their families. The most devastating destruction of the black family was South Africa. And as we look at what Nelson symbolized and what he survived, you have to see what the real deal was. Those women had an undying force in them to reconstitute, even with sticks and stones and tar paper, some shelter where they could raise their children without the men, because the men were caught up into this labor system. Men were chased out of South Africa. ANC had to leave South Africa when they came up with the program of selective violent activity to complement their Gandhian tradition of direct action nonviolence. And so many men left South Africa. Thank you.
sihambanga malahle sivele tala kupayi sangela sawa kuqa hey babe what is this ubamalahle so mamalahle stimela sihambanga malahle sivele tala
policy is one which is called by an Afrikaans word apartheid. And I'm afraid that has been misunderstood so often. It could just as easily and perhaps much better be described as a policy of good neighborliness, accepting that there are differences between people. But while these differences exist and you have to acknowledge them, at the same time, you can live together, aid one another, but that it can best be done when you act as good neighbors always do.
Pass up on the new day, I'm a better.
Kenneth Kaunda, the president of Zambia, at the funeral. He wasn't on the program, but at the last minute, they put him on the program. And so he called them what they were called in the old days, Boers. Even the English-speaking people called them Boers. That's the mix of Dutch, German, French people who were in a struggle in South Africa over who was going to control the wealth of South Africa. And in order to have this struggle, the Boers lost because they didn't have the strength of the English. And the Boers made their trek. The trek meant from the coast into the interior, and that put them in Pretoria and other inland communities where eventually they were farmers, but eventually gold was discovered. All around Johannesburg, you see mountains of the pilings from the gold. You're talking about something 100 feet, 200 feet. So when they discovered the gold, the English followed them and said, we want that too. So there's been a war between white folks, the Boers and the English. And in order for the Boers to survive, they created a secret society like the English had their secret society. So if you don't know, and nobody mentioned it in all the celebration, the Broederbond. When I did the booklet I did to get out to the world body of churches, there was a section of it dealing with the Broederbond. The Broederbond is the secret society that white folks formed who come from the Dutch, German, and French background. 20,000 men sworn to maintain power no matter what. It was formed to fight the English because the English had their secret societies that are formed on the playing fields of Eton. That's the high school where they train their people, and continued in Oxford and Cambridge. That's their special schools. They developed a manhood, brotherhood in the schooling system. So you had the Dutch fighting the English over the gold and the diamonds. And this Broederbond was formed to fight the English, but then when the ANC, and this is at like 1880, 1890, 1900, the English and the Dutch are fighting and have the Boer Wars. Black people start to get their thing together, and it makes sense. When white folks fight each other, that's when we better get off the plantation. When they're having these wars, that's when we better get our movement going and strengthen ourselves. Eventually, this instrument that they had to beat back the Rockefellers, the Rothschilds, the Cecil Rhodes, they're all tied together. When Cecil Rhodes had his dream, Nelson Mandela had a dream of the unity of South Africa, white, black, Asian. Cecil Rhodes had a dream of white supremacy, and he helped to exploit for the English the gold mines, the diamond mines. And in order to do it, he needed money, millions of dollars of English money. And he would go up to Rothschild, the House of Rothschild, and get the millions of dollars to buy another plot of land of these stakeholders in the diamond fields, etc. It's a fantastic history that you need to understand. So we don't need to be mesmerized by the greatness and the humanity of Nelson Mandela. We need to see a global struggle that has an economic dimension, a political dimension, and a cultural dimension. Economic. South Africa is one of the richest parts of the world, and they intend to keep it in control of white folks. Cecil Rhodes had a deep burning in his belly that there should be an English empire from Cairo to the Cape in South Africa. And his dream was it should be maintained and sustained by a secret society of men of a particular persuasion. Cecil Rhodes' plan was to have a linkage between Cairo to the Cape for the English using Rothschild money. He bought up the Kimberley diamond mines that are in Rhodesia and the gold mines that are in South Africa. So when you talk about gold and diamonds, you've got to see these giant corporations, De Beers and others. So that's the thing that we need to look at.
Mm-hmm.
lion peacefully sleeping. Campfire far off in the distance, that beautiful mountain. Drums are throbbing, time to go out hunting, Kilimanjaro. Hello. Kill him. Kill the savage lion before the lion kills you.
I had to monitor all the reports coming from South Africa. I had to get all the documents together. Every black spot. You know what a black spot is? Well, in the South African struggle, a black spot is not the stuff you see on television where they're saying, if you got a black spot, you can get some, what is that, Ambi or something, Nadnola, something, some bleaching cream. When you're talking about the South African context of the great struggle that Nelson Mandela symbolizes, you're talking about the taking away of black land. Whenever they wanted black land, they declared it a black spot. And they went and they took the land. There was a whole fight over the different communities. Whole communities would declare black spot. That meant the white folks wanted the land. And interesting enough, they recorded this. They computerized their taking of the land. And the black folks resisted. Now, while Nelson was breaking rocks, what did that resistance involve? It involved the women. Women are, unfortunately for Bob and myself, women are rigged up, wired up differently than us. And women will fight, particularly for their children. They'll fight for their homes. And whenever these white folks came to take a black spot, a black community, they wouldn't tell anybody. They would come in the middle of the night with bulldozers, and they would knock these homesteads down. And they would do it again and again. But the resisting spirit that was not captured by the tribute to Nelson Mandela was the women would come back again and again. It was the most fantastic thing. They would knock their homes down, and then before they knew it, the women would find the sticks and the tar paper and wood and whatever, and they put those homesteads back together again. They had to have a place for their children. So how did the struggle continue? It was the women. And to take the image that really is riveting for me, and I put it in the work that I did on Southern Africa with the World Council of Churches, is Steve Biko and the students exploded. They had what they called the Black Consciousness Movement, and they stood up before the guns. So you have the struggle in 1960. That was the famous ANC struggle, Sharpsburg, and the PAC. And Nelson, a few years after that, went into jail. That was the 60 struggle. But then you had the 70 struggle. June the 16th, 1970, the children stood up like Winnie Mandela, and the women stood up. And they shed their blood, the blood of the Lamb. Now, none of that was mentioned in all of the celebration. Not a scene, not anything of the black children of Soweto and other townships that were willing to stand up before the guns and get gunned down. Every June the 16th, we should have a celebration in the black world community on the blood of the lambs. And that picture of Hector Peterson, one of the other youngsters, taking them away from the slaughter. And last year, I had a chance to go to South Africa and actually see and feel that experience. They have a memorial. But some of the images we should have seen should have been the memorial of the children who've shed the blood. Then when the system of super exploitation, dehumanization of Africanness got the message that the women were not going to stop trying to be women and family members, that the children were not going to learn the oppressor's language, the language, not even English. They had imposed Afrikaans. That's the language of the Afrikaner. Nobody in the world speaks that, but the few people that represent that community in South Africa. You talk about complete brainwashing of our children. And this hit me because as I began to get the information and the data and whatnot, this control over the mind existed from slavery and post-slavery, exploitation, colonialism. But the Afrikaner people had perfected the destruction of the black community. Now, what am I talking about? The key to control and oppression is the mind. They had their brightest people, and they put the brightest people in charge of the education of black folk, because it was going to be a miseducation. It was going to be education so that you worshiped white folks. It was going to be an education so you couldn't see God as a part of your experience. That South Africa needs to be studied in terms of the struggle of a people, not the glorification of a man from, what do you say, Bob, from prison to the presidency. There's a whole experience of black struggle that needs to be studied and elevated. We have the children dying in our struggle in America, particularly those four girls bombed in that church. But you had children in South Africa on the move. You had thousands of them willing to move together. We had thousands going into that around the King movement, and when the adults couldn't do it, thousands of our children did. So we need to relate our children struggling in the South with the struggle of the children in South Africa, with the struggle of the women in South Africa, with the dehumanization of the men in South Africa.
Uhuru! Freedom! Freedom first. Africa, where the great Congo flows. Where the whole jungle knows a new dawning breaks.
Africa!
A young nation awakes.
Africa!
Uhuru!
Africa!
Uhuru! Africa, ambako jua la angaza sana. Africa, ambako ulimwengu wote kwanza. Africa, kutoka usiku wa jana. Uhuru, upepo wa uhuru. Upepo wa uhuru unavuma. The freedom wind blows. Out of yesterday's night, uhuru.
Freedom!
Uhuru!
Freedom!
Uhuru!
Freedom!
WBAI New York, 99.5 FM. Sugar in My Bowl is the name of this program. We are taking a look at Nelson Mandela and the South African Freedom Movement. What we're listening to right now is part two of Uhuru Kwanzaa. It's the first movement. Before that, we heard the introduction, Uhuru Kwanzaa, part one. Had the poetry of Langston Hughes read by Tutameke Sanga. And, there are lots of musicians on here, including Clark Terry, Freddie Hubbard, Gigi Grice, Yusef Lateef. Of course, this is Randy Weston's Uhuru Africa. Uhuru Kwanzaa is the name of the piece. And before that, we heard Kilimanjaro. We heard Kilimanjaro and Indodenyama Verevud. Well, Indodenyama, and it's Beware Verevud for Henrik Verevud. He was the architect of apartheid in South Africa. By the way, Uhuru Africa is a 1960 Roulette Records release, and Kilimanjaro and Ndotenyama is from a compilation Africa on Novus Records. It was originally recorded in 1965 from an evening with Belafonte and Makeba, Harry Belafonte and Marian Makeba. This is a 1991 Novus BMG compilation. Before that, we heard Stimela by Humesa Kela from Hope. It's a 1988. Hank, there's a correction. Triloka Records release. Actually, it's 2002. I have the wrong year-end record label. So that's a correction that needs to be made for the playlist that is up. That's probably on the Sugar site by now. Before that, we heard our theme, I Want a Little Sugar in My Bowl by Nina Simone from The Very Best of Nina Simone. Originally recorded in 1967, and this is from a 1998 RCA BMG Records release. Stay tuned for more words from Nana Dr. Leonard Jeffries, and we'll also hear from varying other folks. Rashida Ismaili Abubakar. I should have written it out. If you also go to sugar, sugamibowl.org, you can find out more about what's happening tonight. And let me let you hear the rest of this while I organize my thoughts. This is WBAI New York.
Rashida Ismaili Abubakar.
I was going to say that it happened because of the Sharpeville massacre, but I think it was really my sense of politics before that time. I am a pre-end of colonialism, if there ever was, child. And so in 1956-57, when Chinua Achebe wrote Things Fall Apart, and then right during this time, there was this push and call for, quote, winds of change across Africa, and that we had to have our own sovereignty, et cetera, especially pushed by and led by Kwame Nkrumah. But always we used to say these things, but I didn't fully understand them, and we have to liberate South Africa. But I wasn't quite sure about what that meant, because our politics, whatever we were involved with, was always so local. And then when I came abroad to go to school, you're so busy trying to understand the terrain, get your papers in on time, read all the books, understand who people are, that you get caught up in another kind of a world. But I was always hearing little things about South Africa, in addition to which I was hearing little things about what was happening in the South. And I had a lot of friends who were from the South and who were telling me about their relatives. This one got beat up because they went to a demonstration, that person. And so I felt, even though I was really very much involved in my own studies, I really felt that I couldn't just be in my studies divorced from what was happening. But I wouldn't say that I was necessarily political. I think two things that really pushed me more into politics. After independence in Ghana, it really reverberated that Nkrumah says that the sovereignty of Ghana was meaningless without the sovereignty of the rest of Africa. And that still holds today, that the sovereignty and the independence and the mutual cooperation of the states in Africa are meaningless if that doesn't happen. And then people started leaving South Africa and ending up in Nigeria, in Ghana. We started to talk. And then there was this moment at which I guess I threw down the gauntlet and became, quote, political. When Patrice Lumumba was assassinated, for me, that was the major turning point. Even though I was very hurt by the Sharpeville massacre, but for some reason, the assassination of Patrice Lumumba really made me reassess myself, reassess what I was doing, my priorities, because I was a music and literature graduate student, and I was really thinking that I would be Africa's first opera singer. And it was a whole group of us artists who had come abroad to study, and we were going to do all these wonderful things through art. And it really seemed like at that moment, that was not the right path for me. So I started just paying attention to groups that were organized, a lot of organization around what had happened to Patrice Lumumba. There was a UN takeover by people that I knew. I mean, and I suddenly saw all these people that I knew, and they were doing all these things for Africa. And here I was, an African born, and they were leading, they were teaching me in many ways. And then I guess the next thing was just meeting a lot of the people who came out of South Africa, Hugh Masekela. There was a big airlift that Harry Belafonte and Sidney Poitier, along with others, but they were the main drive. And they brought over all these students from South Africa, from Southern Africa, but South Africa in particular, and Kenya. And then I was involved with the Pan-African Students Organization. So all of these things led me to a kind of political awareness place that I had to find out what it was wherever I was physically that I could do, even if it was just telling people, because that's about all I could do, telling them there's a place, you know, Africans are in the majority, like 2/3 of the population is African. And 1/3 of the population not only controls the country and all its wealth, but have reduced the Africans to almost a slave-like state. It was just incredible for anybody to imagine that there could be this kind of total enslavement in another country. And the media was not so forthcoming in showing pictures. Only when something just undeniable happened that they had to. So gradually, just knowing people and hearing their stories, hearing what they went through and how they managed to get out. Some of them left in the middle of the night, couldn't even tell their parents they were going, because when they would turn up missing, they would be considered a part of these renegade people trying to overthrow the government. And of course, you can't possibly want to overthrow a government that did the things that the apartheid and the pre-apartheid government was doing, because then you were saboteurs and terrorists, and et cetera. And I thought, well, if you're not doing that, then you might be a collaborator. So I became careful of who it was I spoke with, because there was lots of intrigue going on in the black community, and especially amongst activists. And for a while, you didn't really know who you could talk with. And finally, just knowing them and listening to their stories and sometimes listening to BBC, I just said, okay, this is an untenable situation. And almost, like I said, we always had these things about South Africa, but I don't think we really knew a lot about what we were talking about. And then to realize that as an African, there were places in Africa I was not allowed to get a visa. You could not, if you were a black person, you could not go to South Africa as a visitor. You pay your own way and you still couldn't go. They wouldn't give you a visa. So I thought, okay, this is not Pan-Africanism. I'm not for this. So I, you know, just working with cultural organizations, Dennis Brutus started the boycotting, and I think he really did a lot to let people understand just what was going on. Before the Soweto uprising, he had organized, you know, the Olympics, the two brothers that raised their fists. I mean, there was just a lot of organizing that went on before Soweto. But I think when Soweto happened, when those young children were gunned down, that was it. It was the line in the sand. And people then came out more vocally and more visibly against the policies. At the same time, the government here was not having any problem with it and was, in fact, full steam ahead, go ahead and invest, and thought that people who were saying, you need to divest, you need to stop supporting this regime, that they were somehow collaborators of terrorism. None of us were collaborators. We just wanted that kind of oppression to stop. So just things like that.
Thank you.
The South African government was offering scholars as a way around the boycott twice their salary, sometimes three times their salary, to come and do a visiting professorship. And many of these were in places where, I mean, it was complete Africana territory. And I was a member of an organization, and we thought we were a bit more progressive academics. And we come to find out some of our members were doing that. And unfortunately, they were almost all white. And it was very painful because we had to confront them, and it's a black person. So then if they were white, then was that a confirmation that they were always racist? And, you know, it just was a very painful, the whole involvement with the anti-apartheid thing was extremely painful, extremely personal. And I met Duma and Lovu at the time when they were producing a lot of the South African plays. So through the arts, primarily, and the academy, that I was mostly involved that way. And I think all through it, we got information about this person, this Mandela person, but mostly because of what his wife, Winnie Mandela, was doing, because he was already locked up out of sight. He was this woman, an amazing woman who was doing incredibly brave things. We really don't appreciate, I think, fully her contribution. They would have been forgotten had it not been for her. She was in their face every day, and she was absolutely unprotected. 3 o'clock in the morning, somebody knocks on our door, breaks down our door. She's in bed in her nightgown with her two girls. Nobody there to stop them. She's banned. She walks out of the banning, and then she gets imprisoned. People forget she was in jail herself, and not just in jail, solitary confinement. At least Mandela had his comrades with him. She was in solitary confinement, away from her children, solitary confinement. She didn't know what was happening to her children, if they'd been killed. She was abused while she was in there. Nobody wants to talk about that. And a lot of the leadership, their wives and their families, some of them were not in the country. She was in the country. She was in the streets every day. And she was fighting to bring Mandela home every day. And I think that had a lot to do with the development and the momentum of the struggle. I think it was absolutely crucial, because that's why they didn't kill them, because if they had killed them, they would have been martyrs and they would have really been a symbol. But to put them in jail, their intent was to lock them away. People's memories fade. Nobody will remember. Just like the so-called born frees have no memory of what apartheid was like. And so, oh, yeah, he's a name, but they don't understand what all that meant, or at least they say they don't. Their parents do, but that was before me. And so if it was before me, it's history and it doesn't count. So it's a way in which we look at history. And I think by thinking of Mandela, we have a chance to connect history to where we are right now. And so what Mandela talks about, not letting the bitterness destroy you and not letting the anger take over you, I think is a very important lesson, because when the anger destroys you, there's only one place for you to go, and that's to be brutal. The fear fueled the brutality. And then they became angry at the people that they feared, and said, well, if you wouldn't do this, I wouldn't have to do that. And you're making me this way. I'm not really that way. I'm not brutal. I'm not a beast. It's you. And so you're not a rapist because she's not a person. And just like in America, where there's still states where there's no rape between black women and white men. I come to saying all that just to say that I come to this point, sort of a progressive stages of development.
Good evening, jazz fans. This is Hank Williams, and welcome to On the Bandstand, a year-end edition for December 22nd. In this segment of the show, we bring you aerial listings of Sugar and My Bowl guests so you can experience them live. We have another light week of listings for the holiday season, but as always, there are chances to see former guests. We start with pianist Harold Mayburn, who closes out the year at Smoke Jazz with saxophonist Eric Alexander's combos, from the 23rd to January 1st, and you can ring in the new year with them with special New Year's Eve shows. Details are at smokejazz.com. You can see organist Akiko Suruga leading a trio on Saturday, December 28th in a 10:45 p.m. set at the Garage Restaurant, 99 7th Avenue South. Go to garagerest.com. She'll also be sitting in with the Bill Saxton Trio on Sunday the 29th from 2 to 6 in the afternoon at Jacob Restaurant, 142nd and 8th Avenue in Harlem. Go to jacobrestaurant.com for details on that show. Drummer Bobby Sinabria will be with the Sexteto Ibiano on New Year's Eve from 10 p.m. to 1 a.m. at the Bronx Music Heritage Center in the South Bronx. Go to wedco.org for details. That's wedco.org. And admission is very reasonable, less than the price of an average movie. Drummer Will Calhoun has a January 2nd gig at the Brooklyn Bowl with Living Color. See brooklynbowl.com for details. The musical Lady Day continues its run at the Little Schubert Theater on West 42nd Street with vocalist Dee Dee Bridgewater starring as Billie Holiday. Go to ladydaythemusical.com for info and tickets. Looking ahead, there are several Sugar guests who will be at the Winter Jazz Fest that's at multiple venues in Greenwich Village from January 7th to the 11th. Jeff Tane Watts, Lakeisha Benjamin, Mark Carey's Focus Trio, Renee Marie, Howard Johnson and Gravity, the Gary Bartz Quartet, Terry Lynn Carrington, Michelle Rosewoman's New Yoruba, and many more. We'll have more details when we return in January, but see winterjazzfest.com for details. That's winterjazzfest.com, and you might want to get those tickets early. That's all for this week. If you missed anything, you can see the listings at the Sugar in My Bowl blog. Go to sugarinmybowl.org and click the link for the blog. Tonight's playlist and audio from this and previous shows are on the website as well. Remember that WBAI is still in serious financial trouble. Help us stay on the air by pledging whatever you can at give2 WBAI.org, where you can become a WBAI buddy with a monthly pledge. This is Hank Williams signing off. We're off next week, but join us in the new year on January 5th on the Bandstand.
Thank you, Hank Williams, for the Bandstand, and as mentioned, you will hear us next year, January 5th, where, let's see, I think our guests will be, who will it be? gosh, Alphonse Muzon, the drummer, Alphonse Muzon, that's who our guests will be. Stay tuned for more Sugar My Bowl and Rashida Ismaili Abubakar, and Nana Dr. Leonard Jeffries. Omawali Clay, and more.
You're tuned to WBAI, the station that tells our story and tells it like it is. This is Mabel Williams, widow of Robert F. Williams, Negroes with Guns, and you're listening to WBAI, New York, 99.5 FM.
And I mean every word of it.
My name is Ingrid Munson. I'm Quincy Jones Professor of African American Music at Harvard University. There's been a long-standing relationship between the African American struggle for liberation and the South African struggle for liberation. And there's been a musical relationship with South Africa since the end of the 19th century that some of the first global music that came to South Africa was actually a guy named Orpheus McAdoo, who brought a kind of Fisk Jubilee singer kind of sound to South Africa, which influenced the development of choral music in South Africa. The kind of choral music that we hear today in groups like Ladysmith Black Mbazo. And there's a guy named Fight Errolman who's written quite a bit about that. Now, when I researched my book, Freedom Sounds, on the civil rights movement, I was very interested in international connections. One of the things, there was a tremendous interest in jazz in South Africa from also early in the development of jazz. there were many South African jazz musicians who modeled themselves, for example, on Louis Armstrong or on bebop artists. Dizzy Gillespie, I actually think Robin Kelly has written about this. You can probably get the names from that. And in the 1950s and the early 1960s, a number of South African jazz musicians emigrated from South Africa. Jazz represented a kind of liberating music, a liberating modern music in contemporary South Africa, since the agenda of the apartheid movement was to move people into their so-called tribal homeland, which were actually kind of a construction of the apartheid state. So they were being told that they were to separate themselves in their traditional groups and be in the countryside and just practice their traditional music. So just doing traditional music there became kind of coded as being put in your place. So there was a kind of progressive association, modernist, you know, let's be in touch with the world kind of association with jazz. Now, one of the most famous people to emigrate from South Africa was Dollar Brand, who later is known as Abdullah Ibrahim. He and his wife, Fatima B. Benjamin, go to Europe, and they are fortunate enough to encounter Duke Ellington, I think in a club in Switzerland. And Duke Ellington became a champion of Dollar Brand Abdullah Ibrahim and became part of Abdullah Ibrahim developing an international reputation.
Endless days, loneliness. filled with tender, sweet memories of him and their great love she holds so dear. Within her heart, his dream, her dream, their vision, peace and freedom for us all.
Fatima was a woman whose parents came from one of the islands just off the coast, like Robben Island, something like that. But these were little islands off the coast of the mainland of South Africa. And her parents were, I guess, what they classified as colored. And she always wanted to sing. She said she always was singing, and she loved to sing, and she was happy when she was singing. There was some challenges in the personal life of her as a child and growing up. But, I mean, that's to be understood. It was a very difficult life for anybody. So she would go to these places when she was like a teenager and just kind of hang around and try to sing. Somebody, you know, a couple of people in her family, I think her grandmother, sang in a church. It's interesting that African people in Southern Africa, there's a kind of a parallel between Southern Africa and the United States, especially with regards to race relations and the development of a music out of that specific experience. And because it was a major port, lots of African American seamen came there, and there was this very rich exchange of music. So jazz has a very long history in Southern Africa, also from Holland as well. Not maybe so much from Germany, but certainly from Holland. So there was this history of these music, and when records, at that point, they were breakable records, you know, somebody would get a record. I mean, it was, that record was recycled around and around and around. And there were one or two stores where they would sell these records. They'd get them when the ships came in. We didn't have all this fast, all these places now, FedEx and all the places where you could just do overnighters in 2 days. You know, it wasn't like that. And they were accommodating this jazz form to their specific rhythms, which comes from the language, etc. And she used to hang out in this particular club in Cape Town. And there she met Dollar Brand, whose name now is Abdullah Ibrahim. And he was this very complicated musician. I mean, we would say crazy in the sense that he had just this sort of a no-holds-barred kind of attitude towards playing and what could be done and how he was seeing and hearing music. I mean it in that sense. And they formed an attachment. But at the same time, they had to live within the constraints of apartheid. And it got increasingly more and more cruel and more restrictive and repressive to the point where black musicians could only play with black musicians. White musicians could only play with white musicians. And coloreds, depending on where they were, could not play with other. I mean, it was just a total apartheid, a total separation of whatever they thought were races. But they had had a couple of musicians who were white because they liked the music as well. And the life was just really becoming more unbearable. And as a musician, it was really difficult for them to survive as creative beings. So they decided that they would join the large exiting group of musicians and artists and try to find some place where they could be artists. So Abdullah was getting some work at that point. He went to the Scandinavian countries. They tended to be more supportive, more receptive to the music. And he went there, and then she followed, and he was able to get some work for her, and they started working in the clubs. Eventually, she persisted in meeting Duke Ellington by going at like 2 o'clock in the morning after they performed to go and meet him, because she felt like if she could just let him hear the group that he would like them, or at least she was really pushing Abdullah. And he came. He was so impressed that she would do that. They got in a cab at 3 o'clock in the morning. She's banging on the club door. And when they see Duke Ellington, they open up the door. And they played for him. And he said, okay, can you be at the studio in the morning? And that's how you have a morning in Paris, because it was a morning in Paris.
And I
stare, I'm sure that I'll soon go mad. In my solitude, I'm praying dear Lord above, send back my love. Dear Lord above, send
And he helped them come here, and he sponsored her here. I met her shortly after they got here. And I would say that we had a very sisterly relationship, both with Abdullah and the two children. Fatima was a very internal, very deep person. Music was a form of worship almost to her. And she really revered all the musicians that she played with. And there were three or four that she really, really just... I mean, to play with them was, to her, an honor. That was Billy Higgins on drum, Buster Williams, Kenny Barron, Onaji Gums. I mean, these were the musicians that... I mean, she played with others, Ricky Ford, and it wasn't like she didn't like them, but she mostly had a small, tight-knit trio, and it was usually Billy Higgins, Buster Williams, and Kenny Barron that she would record with and play. She made about 5 or 6 albums. But she really lived for music. And she was always trying to find that music that would really help her release the creative urges that she had. But also, she was interested in jazz. She saw jazz as a very high art form. And she saw the musicians, she used to refer to them as spiritual soldiers. Yeah, so it's, and Fatima was very very special in my life, and I mean to know her for more than 3 decades, a very spiritual thing. And it was sad that someone who was so she was very loving, she passed in South Africa. I mean, she'd finally gone back. I think when the Chelsea just finally closed, like that was her place. That's where they lived, and so finally. Like that place, her place, she used to say New York was her home. She made New York her home. It was her country. And so now she didn't have her base. She had gotten a place in Cape Town before. And so that's where she went back. And she had just been honored about 2 weeks before that with a very high honor for cultural workers in South Africa. And then 2 weeks later, she was gone. She transitioned the end of August.
Meanwhile, back in South Africa, the people who were trying to play jazz were always one step ahead of the South African police, in particular the group that were integrated, and there were a couple of them played a, you know, hide and seek, very often with the South African police and their identity cards to go and play in various places within South Africa. Now, they were also looking to the American Civil Rights Movement, which gets great press and great coverage around about the same time as they're having. The Sharpsville Massacre, I think it was in about May 1960, happened in response to South Africans protesting their identity cards. And it was brutally repressed by the South African police. Max Roach at this time is working on the Freedom Now suite. And he decides to have the last movement of the Freedom Now suite be Tears from Johannesburg, which was specifically a commemoration of the massacre in Sharpeville, which then, if you look at the politics of that as a piece in the U.S., Max structured those movements to start at the time of enslavement, Drive a Man being the first one, then move to Emancipation Day, Freedom Day, moving to prayer, protest, peace, which was about the contemporary civil rights structure, and then moving to Africa, all Africa, and this having Babatunde Olatunji shouting out the names of all sorts of African ethnic groups and, you know, with a Pan-Africanist sensibility and trying to have an African sound to the music. And then the final piece is Tears from Johannesburg. So there is a way in which then the American civil rights movement in this piece is told to look beyond to Africa in the future and to viewing its struggle as part of the Pan-African struggle. When I came across the thing when I was doing my research, the Freedom Now suite had literally been banned in South Africa. But it just goes to show you how people like Max Roach and other people in the jazz world, they were aware of what was going on. That is one of the most direct relationships with South Africa and American jazz in the early 1960s. The other thing to know about is this is a time when Miriam Makeba and Hugh Masekela come to the United States. And this is part of, they weren't presented as jazz, they were kind of presented as folk music, part of progressive folk music, but they were put on at places like the Village Gate, which was a club in Lower Manhattan run by Art Glugoff, who came out of the union movement and was very interested in both folk music and jazz. And as a result of that, there were a number of events at the Village Gate in the early 1960s that brought Africans and African Americans together to talk about the politics of the moment, which was very much civil rights movement, black nationalism, pan-Africanism. If you go through the civil rights record, you will note that dozens and dozens of organizations, not only from South Africa, but from West Africa and East Africa, wrote to the leaders of the American civil rights movement to ask for advice and guidance in mounting political struggles. So these are among the things that I know about that specifically relate to South Africa. But it seems to me that there's always been a sense of kinship. It's sort of like comparative segregation. You've got the United States with a certain kind of segregation and apartheid, and you have South Africa with this especially brutal form of apartheid and segregation. So people have always felt this deep affinity.
This is WBAI New York 99.5 FM. Sugar in my bowl. What we're hearing in the background is Boogie Stop Shuffle. The Blue Notes is the name of this group. It's one of those interracial groups. Actually, it was one guy, Chris McGregor, who is the he was non-white. He was white. Everybody else was non-white. Ian Huntley's Reel to Reel collection. That's where this came from. That's why it sounds kind of fuzzy. But it's a performance at Wits University on March 22nd, 1963. As I mentioned, Chris McGregor on piano, Elijah Nikwanyana on trumpet. Says he also plays a little baritone sax somewhere. Dudu Pukwana on alto saxophone, the great Dudu Pukwana. Martin Ingijima on bass, and Ian Huntley wasn't certain who the drummer was, but he believed it was Early Mabuza. And before that, we heard Tears for Johannesburg from Max Roach and Oscar Brown Jr.'s We Insist Freedom Now Suite. That's Max Roach on drums, Abby Lincoln on vocals, Booker Little on trumpet, Julian Priester on trombone, Walter Benton, Coleman Hawkins on tenor saxophone, James Schenck on bass, Michael Babatunde Olotunji on congas, Ray Mantilla, and Tomas Duval on percussion, and that's a 1960 Candid Records release. Before that, we heard Solitude from Satima B. Benjamin, A Morning in Paris, Abdullah Ibrahim on piano, Johnny Gertz on bass, and Makaya Nshoko on drums. And that was originally recorded in 1965. It was a 1997 release on Engine Records. It took that long for it to be released because apparently the recordings were lost. But the engineer recorded too. Oh, wow. All right, let me hurry up. Winnie Mandela, Beloved Heroine, Satima B. Benjamin from Love Light, Ricky Ford, tenor saxophone, Larry Willis, piano, Buster Williams, bass, Billy Higgins, drums, 1991 Engine release. Before that, we heard The Damned Don't Cry, John Coltrane, Africa Brass, Impulse Records, 1961. Stay tuned for more. Sugar in My Bowl, Nelson Mandela, South African Liberation Movement Program. Thank you, Ingrid Munson. And, Rashida, Ishmaeli, Abubakar, Nana Dr. Leonard Jeffries, and Omawali Clay will be coming up later. Stay tuned. This is WBAI New York 99.5 FM.
But we can't let that blind us to the reality. And so if there is a case for reparations on the planet, the best case for reparations is the Republic of South America. Nowhere has the stealing of black land been so thoroughly recorded, has the taking of gold, every nugget of gold is recorded, every diamond is recorded, and the slave wages that they pay is recorded. So if there was one place on the planet where reparations could have and should have been raised, it was in South Africa.
This is Omawali Clay. I'm speaking on behalf of the December 12th movement and the Freedom Party. We have all been taken back and yet at the same time very proud of the history of Madiba, our brother Nelson Mandela. And with his passing, I can't help bring it to mind about our brother who is with us still physically, but because of his illness, not mentally, but our brother Ilumbe Brath, because if it was not for Ilumbe Brath and the Brath family and Ajaz and George Tate, early Pan-Africanists like that, so many of us would not have really understood what the struggle in South Africa was about. And there's an old saying that once something becomes popular, everybody gets on board. You know, I think Langston Hughes called them sunshine soldiers. They always appear when the sun is out, but when the clouds come and the winter comes and things get rough, you can't find them till the sun comes back out. And so Ilumbe was one of those winter soldiers who championed and struggled and brought the issues of South Africa into our homes and into our minds, not through the eyes of the imperialists and the colonialists and the white supremacists, but through the eyes of Africans in terms of looking at our history of struggle. And so it's in that context that we're very proud of the contributions of Nelson Mandela. As the TVs and the radios and the announcements come over the air of what a great man he was and how everybody loves him, we also are very clear about the fact that it wasn't that long ago that he was taken off the United States terrorist list. Nelson Mandela did what he did in the context of his time, and it stands as a historical testament. However, the struggle continues, as they say, in Angola and Mozambique and getting the Lunta Continua, the conditions of our people in South Africa, although they have, quote, political power, it is meaningless without economic power. white folks are doing better in South Africa now almost than they've ever had. And when there are complaints about the conditions of black people, the issue is always go talk to your black government, as if the wealth of South Africa is in the hands of the South African government, is in the hands of private corporations that continue to exploit and brutalize our people through economic terrorism. And so as we remember Nelson Mandela, we have to remember that he stood for the liberation of our people, and those who believe there were shortcomings, fight on. Those who believe that there were errors made, correct them. Those that feel that we have to move forward, move forward. And it's also in that context that we look at the question of what are Africans owed? Colonialism and slavery as practiced in South Africa and Africa and the transatlantic slave trade, which is the European slave trade. Those legacies cannot be removed through books and platitudes and apologies, because the reality is those legacies that continue up until this day, those political economic systems that deprived us of our labor and our development and our resources. We were never a question of whether I'd like you or dislike you, or you're black and I don't like you and I'm white and I'm great. Those things would roll off our backs like water off a duck's back. Those things only take on a material reality through the actual denial of us of our food, clothing, and shelter, the denial of us of our quality of life. In fact, the underdevelopment of our cultures and our social organizations and our nations and our people. And so the resolution of that is not simply apologies. The resolution of that must be material too, and it must be economic. Today, we're fighting, continue to fight, a struggle for the redemption, the rectification, and the healing, and most importantly, the compensation and reparations for what happened to our people. It is significant that it was in Durban, South Africa, that the World Conference Against Racism in 2001 established the question that the transatlantic slave trade and colonialism were crimes against humanity. Being crimes against humanity is very significant because crimes against humanity do not have statutes of limitations. And so the condemnation of the transatlantic slave trade and colonialism as crimes against humanity was very important for the reparations movement, very important for the African consciousness and for the African attitude about what to do about our underdevelopment, because many of us in the reparations movement, of those people who remember Queen Mother Moore's always her slogan, you know, and let's not forget reparations, that reparations is something that's owed. But before you get to something that's owed, you have to first establish what was done for it to be owed. So it's our responsibility now. And Durban set us on a very important course of action. Of course, people might remember that in 2002, the first national reparations rally was held in the United States in Washington, D.C. Over 50,000 people came out. And reparations had gripped our communities, and it gripped our psyche. And because of the war, because of half-steps in terms of our political organizing and in terms of us throwing off the yoke of distractions of the war and many other things happening, the reparations movement went into a lull. And you know the old saying, one step forward, two steps back. I think in this period, one of the things that has completely shaken the world and re-energized the reparations movement was that in July of this year, the CARICOM countries, the 15 CARICOM countries, the Economic Association of Caribbean Nations, had one of their central meetings, and at that meeting they established that they were going to make a serious run at the question of reparations for the damage of the transatlantic slave trade and colonialism in the Caribbean. This is an important step that the governments themselves have taken up this question. They indicated that they, in fact, would establish reparation commissions in all of the CARICOM countries, that those commissions would set about the task of mobilizing, doing research, and organizing around the reparations issues in each country, and that each country would send representatives to a Trans-Caribbean Reparations Commission that would help focus and organize an effort to hold France, Belgium, England, United States accountable for the question of reparations in the Caribbean. That meeting was followed up this September in St. Vincent and the Grenadines under the leadership of Ralph Gonsalves, the Prime Minister, who established that the first Reparations Commission meeting. The December 12th movement was fortunate to be able to go to that meeting as representatives from the diaspora CARICOM countries were basically there at that meeting. Many of the countries had already set up reparations commissions. Places like Suriname and Jamaica and Barbados were a little more advanced on the question than some of the other islands. But the energy and the commitment was there. Out of that meeting, Dr. Hilary Beckles was appointed as the chair of the Trans-Caribbean Reparations Commission. And during that meeting, there was a presentation by a British law firm, the same law firm that won reparations to the Kikuyu in terms of the Mau Mau movement and the brutality of the British against the Mau Mau during the Kenyan independence movement. He won reparations from the descendants of the Mau Mau and came to do a presentation. They were not retained at that point, but they wanted to share some of their ideas to just give people an idea of the different tactical and strategic approaches to that question. And so it was a very fruitful meeting, and we came back from it knowing that this re-energizing of the reparation movement needed to be complemented by a re-energizing of the movement here in the United States. And so this cry of reparations not only resounds itself in the Caribbean, the West, so it's not going to be an easy task. And we didn't take it up because it's easy. We took it up because it's correct. And so therefore, as we look at our situation with the passing of Madiba Nelson Mandela and the times that will produce more leaders that are necessary to continue the African liberation struggle. Straight ahead.
And that was Omawale Clay of the December 12th Movement and the Freedom Party sharing his thoughts about reparations and his contribution to this program, which I thoroughly appreciate. This is New Africa that we're listening to in the background, written by Gretchen Moncour III, Archie Shepp from Kwanzaa Impulse 1974. And that's Archie Shepp on tenor and soprano sax vocals. Jimmy Owens on trumpet. Gretchen Moncour III on trombone. Charles Davis on alto sax. Wilbur Ware on bass. Beaver Harris on drums. And as I mentioned, this is from Kwanzaa, 1974 Impulse Records release. And I actually tried to slip in another one. Another Miles Davis recording, because we played a mantla during On the Bandstand. So stay tuned. This is WBAI New York, 99.5 FM. Actually, I think I'll take this moment to sign off. This has been Sugar in My Bowl. My name's Joyce Jones. I'd like to thank Hank Williams. He's been riding the Facebook event page, and you can find us on Facebook at Sugar, S-U-G-A, in My Bowl, and join us and follow along and find out about the playlist and see artwork and good stuff like that. I'd like to thank Hank Williams again for providing Tutu. I have this on, I think I have it on cassette or something, but I never actually got around to getting it on CD. So he had it, and he informed me of Full Nelson, which was written for Nelson Mandela. This is Miles Davis on trumpet and Marcus Miller on all other instruments. It's a 1986 Warner Brothers release. So we'll be back. Sugar in My Bowl will be back on January 5th, Sunday, January 5th, with Alphonse Muzon, drummer, extraordinaire, Alphonse Mouzon. And I'd like to thank everybody who was able to join us this evening. And if you missed any parts of the show, you can go to archive.wbai.org. It should be up in about, well, when you wake up. If you're going to bed now, it will be there when you wake up. But technically, it'll be there in a half hour at the most. Stay tuned for more. La Nueva Alternativa is coming up next. This is indeed WBAI New York, 99.5 FM and WBAI.org on the web. Happy New Year, Happy Kwanzaa, Happy Christmas, yada, yada, yada. Stay tuned.
Hello, bueno, this is Sonia Sanchez. I urge you to give your generous support to listener-sponsored community radio, WBAI 99.5 FM in New York.